charms case with all the diplomatic skill of which she was mistress. She found Marie reclining at length upon a lounge, supporting herself on one elbow by pillows, while Jane, who had been out shopping, was displaying before her certain samples of thin black stuffs.
"That will do," said Marie, selecting one. "Only I'm not sure about its being properly mourning."
"Laws, missus," said Jane volubly. "Mrs. General Durbin and wore just this very thing, after the General died last summer. It makes up lovely."
"What do you think?" said Marie to Miss Ophelia.
"It's a matter of custom, I suppose," said Miss Ophelia. "You can judge about it better than I."
"The fact is," said Marie, "that I haven't a dress in the world that I can wear, and as I am going to break up the establishment and go off next week, I must decide upon something."
"Are you going so soon?"
"Yes. St. Clair's brother has written, and he and the lawyer think that the servants and furniture had better to be put up at auction and the place left with our lawyer."
"There's one thing I wanted to speak with you about," said Miss Ophelia.
"Augustine promised Tom his liberty, and began the legal forms necessary to it. I hope you will use your influence to have it perfected."
"Indeed, I shall do no such thing," said Marie sharply. "Tom is one of the most valuable servants on the place. It couldn't be afforded, anyway. Besides, what does he want of liberty? He's a great deal better off as he is."
"But he does desire it very earnestly, and his master promised it," said Miss Ophelia.
"I dare say he does want it," said Marie. "They all want it, just because they are a discontented set, always wanting what they haven't got. Now, I'm principled against emancipation. In any case, keep a negro under the care of a master, and he does well enough, and is respectable, but set them free, and they get lazy, and won't work, and take to drinking, and go all down to the mean, worthless fellows. I've seen it tried hundreds of times. It's no favor to set them free."
"But Tom is so steady, industrious, and pious."
"Oh, you needn't tell me. I've seen 100 like him. He'll do very well, as long as he's taken care of, that's all."
"But then consider," said Miss Ophelia, "when you set him up for sale, the chances of his getting a bad master."
"Oh, that's all humbug," said Marie. "It isn't one time in 100 that a good fellow gets a bad master. Most masters are good, for all that talk is made. I've lived and grown up here in the South, and I never yet was acquainted with a master that didn't treat his servants well, quite as well as is worthwhile. I don't feel any fears on that head."
"Well," said Miss Ophelia energetically, "I know it was one of the last wishes of your husband that Tom should have his liberty. It was one of the promises that he made to dear little Eva on her deathbed, and I should not think you would feel at liberty to disregard it."
Marie had her face covered with her handkerchief at this appeal, and began sobbing and using her smelling bottle with great vehemence.
"Everybody goes against me," she said. "Everybody is so inconsiderate. I shouldn't have expected that you would bring up all these remembrances of my troubles to me. It's so inconsiderate. But nobody ever does consider my trials are so peculiar. It's so hard that when I had only one daughter, she should have been taken, and when I had a husband that just exactly suited me, and I'm so hard to be suited, he should be taken, and you seem to have so little feeling for me, and keep bringing it up to me so carelessly, when you know how it overcomes me. I suppose you mean well, but it is very inconsiderate, very." And Marie sobbed and gasped for breath, and called Mammy to open the window, and to bring her the camphor bottle, and to bathe her head, and unhook her dress, and in the general confusion that ensued, Miss Ophelia made her escape to her apartment. She saw at once that it would do no good to say anything more, for Marie had an indefinite capacity for hysteric fits, and after this, whenever her husband's or poor Eva's wishes with regard to the servants were alluded to, she always found it convenient to set one in operation. Miss Ophelia, therefore, did the next best thing she could for Tom. She wrote a letter to Mrs. Shelby for him, stating his troubles and urging them to send to his relief. The next day, Tom and Adolf and some half a dozen other servants were marched down to a slave warehouse to await the convenience of the trader who was going to make up a lot for auction.
Chapter 30. The Slave Warehouse. A slave warehouse! Perhaps some of my readers conjure up horrible visions of such a place. They fancy some foul, obscure den, some horrible Tartarus, informus, injuns, qui lumen edentum. But no, innocent friend, in these days men have learned the art of sinning expertly and genteelly. so as not to shock the eyes and senses of respectable society. Human property is high in the market, and is therefore well-fed, well-cleaned, tended, and looked after, that it may come to sale sleek and strong and shiny. A slave warehouse in New Orleans is a house externally not much unlike many others, kept with neatness, and where every day you may see arranged, under a sort of shed, along the outside rows of men and women, who stand there as a sign of the property sold within. Then you shall be courteous, entreated to call and examine, and shall find an abundance of husbands, wives, brothers, sisters, fathers, mothers, and young children to be sold separately, or in lots to suit the convenience of the purchaser, and that soul immortal, one spot with blood and anguish by the Son of God, when the earth shook, and the rocks rent, and the graves were opened, can be sold, leased, mortgaged, exchanged for groceries or dry goods, to suit the phases of trade, or the fancy of the purchaser. It was a day or two after the conversation between Marie and Miss Ophelia that Tom, Adolph, and about half a dozen others of the St. Clair estate were turned over to the loving-kindness of Mr. Skeggs, the keeper of a depot on street, to await the auction next day. Tom had with him quite a sizable trunk full of clothing, as had most others of them. They were ushered for the night into a long room where many other men of all ages, sizes, and shades of complexion were assembled, and from which roars of laughter and unthinking merriment were proceeding. "Ha! That's right. Go it! Boys, go it!" said Mr. Skeggs, the keeper. "My people are always so merry. Sambo, I see," he said, speaking approvingly to a burly negro who was performing tricks of low buffoonery, which occasioned the shouts which Tom had heard. As might be imagined, Tom was in no humor to join these proceedings, and therefore, setting his trunk as far as possible from the noisy group, he sat down on it and leaned his face against the wall. The dealers in the human article make scrupulous and systematic efforts to promote noisy mirth among them, as a means of drowning reflection and rendering them insensible to their condition. The whole object of the training to which the negro is put from the time he is sold in the northern market till he arrives south is systematically directed towards making him callous, unthinking, and brutal. The slave dealer collects his gang in Virginia or Kentucky and drives them to some convenient healthy place, often a watering place, to be fattened. Here they are fed full daily, and because some incline to pine, a fiddle is kept commonly going among them, and they are made to dance daily, and he who refuses to be merry, and whose sole thoughts of wife or child or home are too strong for him to be gay, is marked as sullen and dangerous, and subjected to all the evils which the ill will of an utterly irresponsible and hardened man can inflict upon him. Briskness, alertness, and cheerfulness of appearance, especially before observers, are constantly enforced upon them, both by the hope of thereby getting a good master, and the fear of all that the driver may bring upon them, if they prove unsaleable. "What dat ar nigger doin' here?" said Sambo, coming up to Tom, after Mr. Skeggs had left the room. Sambo was a full black, of great size, very lively, voluble, and full of trick and grimace. "What you doin' here?" said Sambo, coming up to Tom, and poking him facetiously in the side. "Meditatin', eh?" "I am to be sold at the auction tomorrow," said Tom quietly. "Sold at auction? Ha, ha, boys! Ain't this here fun? I wish I was gwine that her way, tell you, wouldn't I make him laugh? But how is it? This here a whole lot gwine tomorrow?" said Sambo, laying his head freely on Adolph's shoulder.
"Please do let me alone," said Adolph fiercely, straightening himself up with extreme disgust.
"Well now, boys, this year's a year white niggers. Kind of cream color, you know, scented," said he, coming up to Adolph and snuffing. "Oh, Lord, he do for a tobacco shop. They could keep him to scent snuff. Lord, he keep a whole shop a-gwin. He would." "I say keep off, can't you?" said Adolph, enraged. "Lord, now how touchy he is, we white niggers. Look at us now." And Sambo gave a ludicrous imitation of Adolph's manners. "Here's the airs and graces. We's been in a good family, I specs." "Yes," said Adolph. "I had a master that could have bought you all for old truck." "Laws, now only think," said Sambo, "the gentlemen's that we is."
"I belong to the St. Clair family," said Adolph proud.
"Law, you did. Be hanged if they aren't lucky to get shit of you. Specs they going to trade you off with a lot of crack teapots and sishlek?" said Sambo with a provoking grin.
Adolph, enraged at this taunt, flew furiously at his adversary, swearing and striking on every side of him. The rest laughed and shouted, and the uproar brought the keeper to the door.
"What now, boys? Order, order," he said, coming in and flourishing a large whip.
All fled in different directions except Sambo, who, presuming on the favor which the keeper had to him as a licensed wag, stood his ground, ducking his head with a facetious grin whenever the master made a dive at him.
"Lor, Master Taintus, we're regular stiddy. It's these yer new hands, they's a real aggravatin', kind of pickin' at us all time."
The keeper at this turned upon Tom and Adolph, and distributing a few kicks and cuffs without much inquiry, and leaving general orders for all to be good boys and go to sleep, left the apartment.
While this scene was going on in the men's sleeping room, the reader may be curious to take a peep at the corresponding apartment allotted to the women. Stretched out in various attitudes over the floor, he may see numberless sleeping forms of every shade of complexion, from the purest ebony to white, and of all years, from childhood to old age, lying now asleep. Here is a fine bright girl of 10 years, whose mother was sold out yesterday, and who tonight cried herself to sleep when nobody was looking at her. Here, a worn old negress, whose thin arms and callous fingers tell of hard toil, waiting to be sold tomorrow as a cast-off article, for what can be got for her? And some 40 or 50 others with heads, variously enveloped in blankets or articles of clothing, lie stretched around them. But in a corner, sitting apart from the rest, are two females, of a more interesting appearance than common. One of these is a respectably dressed mulatto woman, between 40 and 50, with soft eyes and a gentle and pleasing physiognomy. She has on her head a high-raised turban, made of a gay red Madras handkerchief, of the first quality. Her dress is neatly fitted and of good material, showing that she has been provided for with a careful hand. By her side, and nestling closely to her, is a young girl of 15, her daughter. She's a quadroon, as may be seen from her fair complexion, though her likeness to her mother is quite discernible. She has the same soft, dark eye, with longer lashes, and her curling hair is of a luxuriant brown. She also is dressed with great neatness, and her white, delicate hands betray very little acquaintance with servile toil. These two are to be sold tomorrow, in the same lot with the St. Clair servants, and the gentleman to whom they belong, and to whom the money for their sale is to be transmitted, is a member of a Christian church in New York, who will receive the money and go thereafter to the sacrament of his Lord and theirs, and think no more of it. These two, whom we shall call Susan and Emmeline, had been the personal attendants of an amiable and pious lady of New Orleans, by whom they had been carefully and piously instructed and trained. They had been taught to read and write, diligently instructed in the truths of religion, and their lot had been as happy and one as in their condition it was possible to be. But the only son of their protectress had the management of her property, and by carelessness and extravagance involved it to a large amount, and at last failed. One of the largest creditors was the respectable firm of B. and Company in New York. B. and Company wrote to their lawyer in New Orleans, who attached the real estate, these two articles and a lot of plantation hands formed the most valuable part of it, and wrote word to that effect to New York. Brother B., being, as we have said, a Christian man and a resident in a free state, felt some uneasiness on the subject. He didn't like trading in slaves and souls of men, of course. He didn't. But then, there were $30,000 in the case, and that was rather too much money to be lost for a principal. And so, after much considering and asking advice from those that he knew would advise to suit him, Brother B. wrote to his lawyer to dispose of the business in the way seemed to him the most suitable, and remit the proceeds. The day after the letter arrived in New Orleans, Susan and Emmeline were attached and sent to the depot to await a general auction on the following morning. And as they glimmer faintly upon us in the moonlight, which steals through the grated window, we may listen to their conversation. Both are weeping, but each quietly, that the other may not hear. "Mother, just lay your head on my lap and see if you can't sleep a little," says the girl, trying to appear calm. "I haven't any heart to sleep, Em. I can't. It's the last night we may be together." "Oh, Mother, don't say so. Perhaps we shall get sold together. Who knows?" "'Twas anybody else's case, I should say so too, Em," said the woman. "But I'm so feared of losing you that I don't see anything but the danger." "Why, Mother, the man said we were both likely and would sell well."
Susan remembered the man's looks and words with a deadly sickness at her heart. She remembered how he had looked at Emmeline's hands, and lifted up her curly hair and pronounced her a first-rate article. Susan had been trained as a Christian, brought up in the daily reading of the Bible, and had the same horror of her child's being sold to a life of shame that any other Christian mother might have. But she had no hope, no protection.
"Mother, I think we might do first rate, if you could get a place as cook, and I as a chambermaid or seamstress, in some family. I dare say we shall. Let's both look as bright and lively as we can, and tell all we can do, and perhaps we shall," said Emmeline.
"I want you to brush your hair all back straight tomorrow," said Susan.
"What for, Mother? I don't look near so well that way."
"Yes, but you'll sell better so."
"I don't see why," said the child. "Respectable families would be more apt to buy you, if they saw you look plain and decent, as if you wasn't trying to look handsome." "I know their ways better than you do," said Susan.
"Well, Mother, then I will. And Emmeline, if we shouldn't ever see each other again, after tomorrow, If I'm sold way up on a plantation somewhere, and you somewhere else, always remember how you've been brought up, and all Missus has told you. Take your Bible with you, and your hymn book, and if you're faithful to the Lord, he'll be faithful to you.
So speaks the poor soul in sore discouragement, for she knows that tomorrow any man, however vile and brutal, however godless and merciless, if he only has money to pay for her, may become owner of her daughter, body and soul. And then how is the child to be faithful? She thinks of all this as she holds her daughter in her arms and wishes that she were not handsome and attractive. It seems almost an aggravation to her to remember how purely and piously, how much above the ordinary lot she has been brought up. But she has no resort but to pray. And many such prayers to God have gone up from those same trim, neatly arranged, respectable slave prisons, prayers which God has not forgotten, as the coming day shall show, for it is written, "Who causeth one of these little ones to offend, it were better for him that a millstone were hanged about his neck, and that he were drowned in the depths of the sea." The soft, earnest, quiet moonbeam looks infixedly, marking the bars of the grated windows on the prostrate, sleeping forms. The mother and daughter are singing together a wild and melancholy dirge, common as a funeral hymn among the slaves. "Oh, where is weeping Mary? Oh, where is weeping Mary? Rived in the goodly land. She's dead and gone to heaven. She's dead and gone to heaven. Rived in the goodly land."
These words sung by voices of a peculiar and melancholy sweetness, in an air which seemed like the sighing of earthy despair after heavenly hope, floated through the dark prison rooms with a pathetic cadence, as verse after verse was breathed out.
"Oh, where are Paul and Silas? Oh, where are Paul and Silas? Gone to the goodly land. They are dead and gone to heaven. They are dead and gone to heaven. Rived in the goodly land."
Sing on, poor souls, the night is short, and the morning will part you forever. But now it is morning, and everybody is astir, and the worthy Mr. Skeggs is busy and bright, for a lot of goods is to be fitted out for auction. There is a brisk lookout on the toilet, injunctions passed around to everyone to put on their best face and be spry, and now all are arranged in a circle for a last review, before they are marched up to the bourse. Mr. Skeggs, with his palmetto on and his cigar in his mouth, walks around to put farewell touches on his wares. "How's this?" he said, stepping in front of Susan and Emmeline. "Where's your curls, gal?" The girl looked timidly at her mother, who, with the smooth adroitness common among her class, answers, "I was telling her last night to put up her hair smooth and neat, and not having it flying about in curls. Looks more respectable, so." "Father," said the man, peremptorily, turning to the girl, "you go right along and curl yourself real smart," he added, giving a crack to a rattan he held in his hand, "and be back in quick time, too." "You go and help her," he added to the mother. "Them curls may make $100 difference in the sale of her." Beneath a splendid dome were men of all nations moving to and fro over the marble pave. On every side of the circular area were little tribunes or stations for the use of speakers and auctioneers. Two of these, on opposite sides of the area, were now occupied by brilliant and talented gentlemen, enthusiastically forcing up, in English and French, commingled, the bids of connoisseurs in their various wares. A third one, on the other side still unoccupied, was surrounded by a group waiting the moment of sale to begin. And here we may recognize the St. Clair servants, Tom, Adolf, and others. And there too Susan and Emmeline, awaiting their turn with anxious and dejected faces, various spectators intending to purchase or not intending, examining and commenting on their various points and faces, with the same freedom that of a set of jockeys discuss the merits of a horse. "Aloha, Alf! What brings you here?" said a young exquisite, slapping the shoulder of a sprucely dressed young man who was examining Adolf through an eyeglass. "Well, I was wanting a valet, and I heard that St. Clair's lot was going. I thought I'd just look at his." "Catch me ever buying any of St. Clair's people. Spoilt niggers. Every one. Impudent as the devil," said the other. "Never fear that," said the first. "If I get 'em, I'll soon have the airs out of them. They'll soon find that they've another kind of master to deal with than Monsieur St. Clair. Upon my word. I'll buy that fellow. I like the shape of him. You'll find it'll take you all you've got to keep him. He's deucedly extravagant." "Yes, but my lord will find that he can't be extravagant with me. Just let him be sent to the calaboose a few times and thoroughly dressed down. I'll tell you if it don't bring him to a sense of his ways. Oh, I'll reform him uphill and down, you'll see. I buy him, that's flat." Tom had been standing wistfully examining the multitude of faces thronging around him, for one whom he would wish to call master. and if you should ever be under the necessity, sir, of selecting, out of 200 men, one who was to become your absolute owner and disposer, you would perhaps realize, just as Tom did, how few there were that you would feel at all comfortable in being made over to. Tom saw abundance of men, great, burly, gruff men, little chirping, dried men, long-favored, lank, hard men, and every variety of stubbed-looking, commonplace men, who pick up their fellow men as one picks up chips, putting them into the fire or a basket, with equal unconcern, according to their convenience. But he saw no St. Clair. A little before the sale commenced, a short, broad, muscular man, in a check shirt considerably open at the bosom, and pantaloons much the worse for dirt and wear, elbowed his way through the crowd, like one who is going actively into a business, and coming up to the group began to examine them, systematically. From the moment that Tom saw him approaching, he felt an immediate and revolting horror at him, that increased as he came near. He was evidently, though short of gigantic strength, his round bullet head, large light gray eyes, with their shaggy sandy eyebrows and stiff wiry sunburned hair, were rather unprepossessing items. It is to be confessed, his large coarse mouth was distended with tobacco, the juice of which from time to time he ejected from him with great decision and explosive force. His hands were immensely large, hairy, sunburned, freckled, and very dirty, and garnished with long nails, in a very foul condition. This man proceeded to a very free, personal examination of the lot. He seized Tom by the jaw, and pulled open his mouth to inspect his teeth, made him strip up his sleeve to show his muscle, turned him around, made him jump and spring to show his paces. "Where was you raised?" he added briefly to those investigations. "In Kentuck, massa," said Tom, looking about, as if for deliverance. "What have you done?" "Had care of massa's farm," said Tom. "Likely story," said the other, shortly, as he passed on. He paused a moment before Dolph, then spitting a discharge of tobacco juice on his well-blacked boots, and giving a contemptuous oomph, he walked on. Again he stopped before Susan and Emmeline. He put out his heavy, dirty hand, and drew the girl towards him, passed it over her neck and bust, felt her arms, looked at her teeth, and then pushed her back against her mother, whose patient face showed the suffering she had been going through at every motion of the hideous stranger. The girl was frightened and began to cry. "Stop that, you minx," said the salesman. "No whimpering here. The sale is going to begin, and accordingly the sale begun." Adolf was knocked off at a good sum to the young gentleman who had previously stated his intention of buying him, and the other servants of the St. Clair lot went to various bidders. "Now up with you, boy. Do you hear?" said the auctioneer to Tom. Tom stepped upon the block, gave a few anxious looks round. All seemed mingled in a common, indistinct noise. The clatter of the salesman crying off his qualifications in French and English, the quick fire of French and English bids, and almost in a moment came the final thump of the hammer, and the clear ring on the last syllable of the word, dollars, as the auctioneer announced his price, and Tom was made over. He had a master. He was pushed from the block. The short, bullet-headed man, seizing him roughly by the shoulder, pushed him to one side, saying in a harsh voice, "Stand there, you!" Tom hardly realized anything, but still the bidding went on. Ratting, clattering, now French, now English. Down goes the hammer again. Susan is sold. She goes down from the block, stops, looks wistfully back. Her daughter stretches her hands towards her. She looks with agony in the face of the man who has bought her, a respectable middle-aged man of benevolent countenance. "Oh, massa, please do buy my daughter." "I'd like to, but I'm afraid I can't afford it," said the gentleman, looking with painful interest as the young girl mounted the block and looked around her with a frightened and timid glance. The blood flushes painfully in her otherwise colorless cheeks. Her eye has a feverish fire, and her mother groans to see that she looks more beautiful than she ever saw her before. The auctioneer sees his advantage, and expatiates volubly in mingled French and English, and bids rise in rapid succession. "I'll do anything in reason," said the benevolent-looking gentleman, pressing in and joining with the bids. In a few moments they have run beyond his purse. He is silent. The auctioneer grows warmer, but bids gradually drop off. It lies now between an aristocratic old citizen and our bullet-headed acquaintance. The citizen bids for a few turns, contemptuously measuring his opponent, but the bullet-head has the advantage over him, both in obstinacy and concealed length of purse. And the controversy lasts but a moment. The hammer falls. He has got the girl, body and soul, unless God help her. Her master is Mr. Legree, who owns a cotton plantation on the Red River. She is pushed along into the same lot with Tom and two other men, and goes off weeping as she goes. The benevolent gentleman is sorry, but then the thing happens every day. One sees girls and mothers cry at these sales, always. It can't be helped, and see. And he walks off, with his acquisition, in another direction. 2 days after, the lawyer of the Christian firm of B and Company, New York, send on their money to them. On the reverse of that draft so obtained, let them write these words of the great paymaster, to whom they shall make up their account in a future day. When he maketh inquisition for blood, he forgetteth not the cry of the humble.
Chapter 31. The Middle Passage. Thou art of purer eyes than to behold evil, and canst not look upon iniquity. Wherefore lookest thou upon them that deal treacherously, and holdest thy tongue when the wicked devoureth the man that is more righteous than he. Hab 1:13. On the lower part of a small, mean boat on the Red River, Tom sat, chains on his wrists, chains on his feet, and a weight heavier than chains lay on his heart. All had faded from his sky, moon, and star. All had passed by him, as the trees and banks were now passing, to return no more. Kentucky home, with wife and children, and indulgent owners, St. Clair home, with all its refinements and splendors, the golden head of Eva, with its saint-like eyes, the proud, gay, handsome, seemingly careless, yet ever kind St. Clair. Hours of ease and indulgent leisure all gone, and in place thereof, what remains? It is one of the bitterest apportionments of a lot of slavery, that the negro, sympathetic and assimilative, after acquiring in a refined family the tastes and feelings which form the atmosphere of such a place, is not the less liable to become the bond-slave of the coarsest and most brutal. Just as a chair or table, which once decorated the superb saloon, comes at last battered and defaced to the barroom of some filthy tavern, or some low haunt of vulgar debauchery. The great difference is that the table and chair cannot feel, and the man can. For even a legal enactment that he shall be taken, reputed, adjudged in law, to be a chattel personal, cannot blot out his soul, with its own private little world of memories, hopes, loves, fears, and desires. Mr. Simon Legree, Tom's master, had purchased slaves at one place and another in New Orleans, to the number of 8, and driven them, handcuffed, in couples of 2 and 2, down to the good steamer Pirate, which lay at the levee, ready for a trip up the Red River. Having got them fairly on board, and the boat being off, he came round, with that air of efficiency which ever characterized him, to take a review of them. Stopping opposite to Tom, who had been attired for sale in his best broadcloth suit, with well-starched linen and shining boots, he briefly expressed himself as follows. "Stand up." Tom stood up. "Take off that stock." And as Tom, encumbered by his fetters, proceeded to do it, he assisted him by pulling it, with no gentle hand, from his neck and putting it in his pocket. Legree now turning to Tom's trunk, which previous to this he had been ransacking, and taking from it a pair of old pantaloons and dilapidated coat, which Tom had been wont to put on about his stable work, he said, liberating Tom's hands from the handcuffs and pointing to a recess in among the boxes, "You go there, put these on." Tom obeyed, and in a few moments returned. "Take off your boots," said Mr. Legree. Tom did so. "There," said the former, throwing him a pair of coarse, stout shoes, such as were common among the slaves. "Put these on." In Tom's hurried exchange, he had not forgotten to transfer his cherished Bible to his pocket. It was well he did so, for Mr. Legree, having refitted Tom's handcuffs, proceeded deliberately to investigate the contents of his pockets. He drew out a silk handkerchief and put it into his own pocket. Several little trifles which Tom had treasured chiefly because they had amused Eva, he looked upon them with a contemptuous grunt and tossed them over his shoulder into the river. Tom's Methodist hymn book, which in his hurry he had forgotten, he now held up and turned over. "Humph, pious, to be sure. So what's your name? You belong to the church, eh?" "Yes, massa," said Tom firmly. "Well, I'll soon have that out of you. I have none of your bawling, praying, singing niggers on my place, so remember. Now mind yourself," he said, with a stamp and a fierce glance of his gray eye, directed at Tom. "I'm your church now, you understand? You got to be as I say." Something within the silent black man answered, "No!" And as if repeated by an invisible voice came the words of an old prophetic scroll, as Eva had often read them to him. "Fear not, for I have redeemed thee. I have called thee by name. Thou art mine." But Simon Legree heard no voice. That voice is one he never shall hear. He only glared for a moment on the downcast face of Tom, and walked off,
He took Tom's trunk, which contained a very neat and abundant wardrobe, to the forecastle, where it was soon surrounded by various hands of the boat. With much laughing at the expense of niggers who tried to be gentlemen, the articles very readily were sold to one and another. And the empty trunk finally put up at auction. It was a good joke, they all thought, especially to see how Tom looked after his things, as they were going this way and that. And then the auction of the trunk. That was funnier than all, and occasioned abundant witticisms. This little affair being over, Simon sauntered up again to his property. "Now, Tom, I've relieved you of any extra baggage, you see. Take mighty good care of them clothes. It'll be long enough for you get more. I go in for making niggers careful. One suit has to do for 1 year, on my place." Simon next walked up to the place where Emmeline was sitting, chained to another woman. "Well, my dear," he said, chucking her under the chin, "keep up your spirits." The involuntary look of horror, fright, and aversion with which the girl regarded him did not escape his eye. He frowned fiercely. "None of your shines, gal. You's got to keep a pleasant face when I speak to you, do you hear? And you, you old yellow poker moonshine," he said, giving a shove to the mulatto woman to whom Emmeline was chained. "Don't you carry that sort of face. You's got to look chipper, I tell ye. I say all on ye," he said, retreating a pace or two back. "Look at me, look at me, look at me right in the eye, straight now," said he, stamping his foot at every pause. And by a fascination every eye was now directed to the glaring greenish-gray eye of Simon. "Now," said he, doubling his great heavy fist into something resembling a blacksmith's hammer, "do you see this fist? Heft it," he said, bringing it down on Tom's hand. "Look at these yere bones. Well, I tell you this, yere fist has got as hard as iron knocking down niggers. I never see the nigger yet I couldn't bring down with one crack," said he, bringing his fist down so near to the face of Tom that he winked and drew back. "I don't keep none of your cussed overseers. I does my own overseeing, and I tell you things is seen, too. Use every one of ye got to toe the mark, I tell you, quick straight, the moment I speak. That's the way to keep it in with me. You won't find no soft spot in me, nowhere. So now mind yourselves, for I don't show no mercy." The women involuntarily drew in their breath, and the whole gang sat with downcast, dejected faces. Meanwhile, Simon turned on his heel and marched up to the bar of the boat for a dram. "That's the way I begin with my niggers," he said to a gentlemanly man who had stood by him during his speech. "It's my system to begin strong. Just let 'em know what to expect." "Indeed," said the stranger, looking upon him with the curiosity of a naturalist studying some out-of-the-way specimen. "Yes, indeed. I'm none of your gentlemen planters with lily fingers to slop round and be cheated by some old cuss of an overseer. Just feel of my knuckles now. Look at my fist. Tell ye, sir, the flesh on it has come just like a stone. Practicing on nigger. Feel on it." The stranger applied his fingers to the implement in question and simply said, "'Tis hard enough, and I suppose," he added, "practice has made your heart just like it."
"Why, yes, I may say so," said Simon with a hearty laugh. "I reckon there's as little soft in me as in any one going. Tell you, nobody comes it over me. Niggers never gets round me, neither with squalling nor soft soap. That's a fact."
"You have a fine lot there."
"Real," said Simon. "There's that Tom. They told me he was something uncommon. I paid a little high for him, tending him for a driver and a managing chap. Only get the notions out that he's learnt by being treated as niggers never ought to be. He'll do prime. The yellow woman I got took in on? I rather you think she's sickly, but I shall put her through for what she's worth. She may last a year or two. I don't go for saving niggers. Use up and buy more. It's my way. Makes you less trouble, and I'm quite sure it comes cheaper in the end." And Simon sipped his glass.
"And how long do they generally last?" said the stranger.
"Well, dunno, accordin' as their constitution is, stout fellers last 6 or 7 years, trashy ones gets worked up in 2 or 3. I used to, when I first began, have considerable trouble fussin' with them and tryin' to make 'em hold out, doctorin' on 'em up when they're sick and givin' on 'em clothes and blankets and what's not, to keep 'em all sort of decent comfortable. Law, it wasn't no sort of use. I lost money on 'em, and it was heaps of trouble. Now, you see, I just put 'em straight through, sick or well. When one nigger's dead, I buy another, and I find it comes cheaper and easier every way."
The stranger turned away and seated himself beside a gentleman, who had been listening to the conversation with repressed uneasiness. "You must not take that fellow to be any specimen of southern planters," said he.
"I should hope not," said the young gentleman with emphasis. "He is a mean, low, brutal fellow," said the other. "And yet your laws allow him to hold any number of human beings subject to his absolute will, without even a shadow of protection. And low as he is, you cannot say that there are not many such."
"Well," said the other, "there are also many considerate and humane men among planters."
"Granted," said the young man, "but in my opinion, it is you considerate, humane men that are responsible for all the brutality and outrage wrought by these wretches. Because if it were not for your sanction and influence, the whole system could not keep foothold an hour. If there were no planters except such as that one," said he, pointing with his finger to Legree, who stood with his back to them, "the whole thing would go down like a millstone. It is your respectability and humanity that licenses and protects his brutality."
"You certainly have a high opinion of my good nature," said the planter, smiling. "But I advise you not to talk quite so loud, as there are people on board the boat who might not be quite so tolerant to opinion as I am. You had better wait till I get up to my plantation, and there you may abuse us all, quite at your leisure."
The young gentleman colored and smiled, and the two were soon busy in a game of backgammon. Meanwhile, another conversation was going on in the lower part of the boat, between Emmeline and the mulatto woman, with whom she was confined. As was natural, they were exchanging with each other some particulars of their history.
"Who did you belong to?" said Emmeline.
"Well, my master was Mr. Ellis. Lived on Levy Street. Perhaps you've seen the house."
"Was he good to you?" said Emmeline.
"Mostly, till he took sick. He's lain sick off and on more than 6 months, and been awful uneasy. 'Pears like he weren't willing to have nobody rest day or night. Got so curious, there couldn't nobody suit him. 'Pears like he just grew coarser every day, keep me up nights till I got fairly beat out, and couldn't keep wake no longer, and 'cause I got to sleep one night, Lord, he talked so awful to me, and he tell me he'd sell me to just the hardest master he could find, and he'd promised me my freedom, too, when he died."
"Had you any friends?" said Emmeline.
"Yes, my husband. He's a blacksmith.
Master Gently hired him out.
They took me off so quick I didn't even have time to see him, and I's got 4 children. "Oh, dear me," said the woman, covering her face with her hands.
It is a natural impulse in everyone, when they hear a tale of distress, to think of something to say by way of consolation. Emmeline wanted to say something, but she could not think of anything to say. What was there to be said? As by a common consent, they both avoided with fear and dread all mention of the horrible man who was now their master.
True, there is religious trust for even the darkest hour. The mulatto woman was a member of the Methodist Church, and had an unenlightened but very sincere spirit of piety. Emmeline had been educated much more intelligently, taught to read and write, and diligently instructed in the Bible, by the care of a faithful and pious mistress. Yet would it not try the faith of the firmest Christian to find themselves abandoned, apparently, of God, in the grasp of ruthless violence? How much more must it shake the faith of Christ's poor little ones, weak in knowledge and tender in years? The boat moved on, freighted with its weight of sorrow, up the red, muddy, turbid current, through the abrupt, tortuous windings of the Red River, and sad eyes gazed wearily on the steep red clay banks as they glided by in dreary sameness. At last the boat stopped at a small town, and Legree, with his party, disembarked.
Chapter 32. Dark Places. The dark places of the earth are full of the habitations of cruelty. Psalm 74:20. Trailing wearily behind a rude wagon and over a ruder road, Tom and his associates faced onward. In the wagon was seated Simon Legree, and the 2 women, still fettered together, were stowed away with some baggage in the back part of it, and the whole company were seeking Legree's plantation, which lay a good distance off. It was a wild, forsaken road, now winding through dreary pine barrens, where the wind whispered mournfully, and now over log causeways, through long cypress swamps, the doleful trees rising out of the slimy, spongy ground, hung with long wreaths of funeral black moss, while every and anon the loathsome form of the moccasin snake might be seen sliding among broken stumps and shattered branches that lay here and there, rotting in the water. It is disconsolate enough, this riding to the stranger, whom, with well-filled pocket and well-appointed horse, threads the lonely way on some errand of business. But wilder, drearier, to the man enthralled, whom every weary step bears further from all that man loves and prays for.
So one should have thought, that witnessed the sunken and dejected expression on those dark faces, the wistful patient weariness, with which those sad eyes rested on object after object that passed them in their sad journey. Simon rode on, however, apparently well pleased, occasionally pulling away at a flask of spirit, which he kept in his pocket.
"I say you," he said as he turned back and caught a glance at the dispirited faces behind him. "Strike up a song, boys. Come."
The men looked at each other, and the "come" was repeated, with a smart crack of the whip which the driver carried in his hands. Tom began a Methodist hymn.
"Jerusalem, my happy home, name ever dear to me, when shall my sorrows have an end? Thy joys, when shall—"
"Shut up, you black cuss," roared Legree. "Did you think I wanted any of your infernal old Methodism? I say, tune up! Now something real rowdy, quick!"
One of the other men struck up one of these unmeaning songs common among the slaves.
"Massa seed me caught a coon, high boys high. He left a split, you see the moon. Ho, 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 boys ho, 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 hi-ee-ho."
The singer appeared to make up the song to his own pleasure, generally hitting on rhyme without much attempt at reason, and the party took up the chorus at intervals.
"Ho, ho, ho, boys ho, hi-ee-ho, hi-ee-ho."
It was sung very boisterously and with a forced attempt at merriment, but no wail of despair, no words of impassioned prayer, could have had such a depth of woe in them as the wild notes of the chorus, as if the poor dumb heart threatened prison took refuge in that inarticulate sanctuary of music, and found there a language in which to breathe its prayer to God. There was a prayer in it which Simon could not hear. He only heard the boys singing noisily, and was well pleased. He was making them keep up their spirits. "Well, my little dear," said he, turning to Emmeline, and laying his hand on her shoulder, "we're almost home." When Legree scolded and stormed, Emmeline was terrified. But when he laid his hand on her and spoke as he now did, she felt as if she had rather he would strike her. The expression of his eyes made her soul sick and her flesh creep. Involuntarily she clung closer to the mulatto woman by her side, as if she were her mother. "You didn't ever wear earrings," he said, taking hold of her small ear with his coarse fingers.
"No, massa," said Emmeline, trembling and looking down.
"But I'll give you a pair when we get home, if you're a good girl. You needn't be so frightened. I don't mean to make you work very hard. You'll have fine times with me, and live like a lady. Only be a good girl."
Legree had been drinking to that degree that he was inclining to be very gracious, and it was about this time that the enclosures of the plantation rose to view. The estate had formerly belonged to a gentleman of opulence and taste, who had bestowed some considerable attention to the adornment of his grounds. Having died insolvent, it had been purchased at a bargain by Legree, who used it as he did everything else merely as an implement for money-making. The place had that ragged, forlorn appearance which is always produced by the evidence that the care of the former owner has been left to go to utter decay. What was once a smooth-shaven lawn before the house, dotted here and there with ornamental shrubs, was now covered with frowsy, tangled grass with horse spots set up here and there in it, where the turf was stamped away and the ground littered with broken pails, cobs of corn, and other slovenly remains. Here and there a mild weed jessamine or honeysuckle hung raggedly from some ornamental support, which had been pushed to one side by being used as a horse-post. What once was a large garden was now all grown over with weeds, through which, here and there, some solitary exotic reared its forsaken head. What had been a conservatory had now no window-shades, and on the mouldering shelves stood some dry, forsaken flower-pots, with sticks in them, whose dried leaves showed they had once been plants. The wagon rolled up a weedy gravel walk under a noble avenue of china trees, whose graceful forms and ever-springing foliage seemed to be the only things there that neglect could not daunt or alter. Like noble spirits so deeply rooted in goodness as to flourish and grow stronger amid discouragement and decay. The house had been large and handsome. It was built in a manner common at the South, a wide veranda of two stories running round every part of the house, into which every outer door opened, the lower tier being supported by brick pillars. But the place looked desolate and uncomfortable, some windows stopped up with boards, some with shattered panes, and shutters hanging by a single hinge, all telling of coarse neglect and discomfort. Bits of board, straw, old decayed barrels and boxes garnished the ground in all directions, and three or four ferocious-looking dogs, roused by the sound of the wagon wheels, came tearing out, and were with difficulty restrained from laying hold of Tom and his companions by the effort of the ragged servants who came after them.
"You see what you get?" said Legree, caressing the dogs with grim satisfaction and turning to Tom and his companions. "You see what you'd get if you tried her enough. These yer dogs have been raised to track niggers, and they'd just as soon chaw one on ye up as eat their supper. So mind yourself. How now, Sambo?" he said to a ragged fellow, without any brim to his hat, who was officious in his attentions. "How have things been going?"
"First rate, massa."
"Quimbo," said Legree to another, who was making zealous demonstrations to attract his attention, "you minded what I told you?"
"Guess I did, didn't I?"
These two colored men were the two principal hands on the plantation. Legree had trained them in savageness and brutality as systematically as he had his bulldogs, and by long practice in hardness and cruelty, brought their whole nature to about the same range of capacities. It is a common remark, and one that is thought to militate strongly against the character of the race, that the Negro overseer is always more tyrannical and cruel than the white one. This is simply saying that the Negro mind has been more crushed and debased than the white. It is no more true of this race than of every oppressed race the world over. A slave is always a tyrant, if he can get a chance to be one. Legree, like some potentates we read of in history, governed his plantation by a sort of resolution of forces. Sambo and Quimbo cordially hated each other. The plantation hands, one and all, cordially hated them. And by playing off one against another, he was pretty sure, through one or the other of the three parties, to get informed of whatever was on foot in the place. Nobody can live entirely without social intercourse, and Legree encouraged his two black satellites to a kind of coarse familiarity with him. A familiarity, however, at any moment, liable to get one or the other of them into trouble. For on the slightest provocation, one of them always stood ready at a nod to be a minister of his vengeance on the other. As they stood there now by Legree, they seemed an apt illustration of the fact that brutal men are lower even than animals. Their coarse, dark, heavy features, their great eyes, rolling enviously on each other, their barbarous, guttural half-brute intonating, their dilapidated garments fluttering in the wind, were all in admirable keeping with the vile and unwholesome character of everything about the place. "Here you, Sambo," said Legree. "Take these yer boys down to the quarters, and here's a gal I've got for you," said he, as he separated the mulatto woman away from Emmeline and pushed her towards him. "I promised to bring you one, you know." The woman gave a start, and drawing back, said suddenly,
"Oh, massa, I left my old man in New Orleans."
"What of that, you? Won't you want one here?" "None of your words. Go long," said Legree, raising his whip. "Come, mistress," he said to Emmeline, "you go in here with me." A dark, wild face was seen for a moment to glance at the window of the house, and as Legree opened the door, a female voice said something in a quick, imperative tone. Tom, who was looking with anxious interest after Emmeline as she went in, noticed this, and heard Legree answer angrily, "You may hold your tongue! I'll do as I please for all you!" Tom heard no more, for he was soon following Sambo to the quarters. The quarters was a little sort of street of rude shanties in a row, in a part of the plantation far off from the house. They had a forlorn, brutal, forsaken air. Tom's heart sunk when he saw them. He had been comforting himself with the thought of a cottage, rude indeed, but one which he might make neat and quiet, and where he might have a shelf for his Bible, and a place to be alone out of his laboring hours. He looked into several. They were mere rude shells, destitute of any species of furniture, except a heap of straw, foul with dirt, spread confusedly over the floor, which was merely the bare ground, trodden hard by the tramping of innumerable feet. "Which of these will be mine?" said he to Sambo, submissively.
"Dunno. Can turn in here, I suppose," said Sambo. "Specs there's room for another there. There's a pretty smart heap of niggers to each on him. Now, sure, I don't know what I has to do with more."
It was late in the evening when the weary occupants of the shanties came flocking home, men and women in soiled and tattered garments, surly and uncomfortable, and in no mood to look pleasantly on newcomers. The small village was alive with no inviting sounds, hoarse, guttural voices contending at the handmills, where their morsel of hard corn was yet to be ground into meal, to fit it for the cake that was to constitute their only supper. From the earliest dawn of the day, they had been in the fields, pressed to work under the driving lash of the overseers, for it was now in the very heat and hurry of the season, and no means was left untried to press every one up to the top of their capabilities. "True," says the negligent lounger, "picking cotton isn't hard work, isn't it? And it isn't much inconvenience either to have one drop of water fall on your head, yet the worst torture of the Inquisition is produced by drop after drop, drop after drop, falling moment after moment with monotonous succession on the same spot, and work in itself not hard becomes so by being pressed hour after hour with unvarying relenting sameness, with not even the consciousness of free will to take from its tediousness." Tom looked in vain among the gang. As they poured along for companionable faces, he saw only sullen, scowling, embruted men and feeble, discouraged women, or women that were not women. The strong pushing away the weak, the gross, unrestricted animal selfishness of human beings, of whom nothing good was expected and desired, and who, treated in every way like brutes, had sunk as nearly to their level as it was possible for human beings to do. To a late hour in the night the sound of the grinding was protracted, for the mills were few in number compared with the grinders, and the weary and feeble ones were driven back by the strong. and came on last in their turn. "Ho, yo," said Sambo, coming to the mulatto woman and throwing down a bag of corn before her. "What cuss you name?"
"Lucy," said the woman.
"Why, Lucy, you're my woman now. You grind this yer corn and get my supper baked, you hear?"
"I ain't your woman, and I won't be," said the woman with the sharp, sudden courage of despair. "You go along."
"I'll kick yo, then," said Sambo, raising his foot threateningly.
"Ye may kill me, if you choose.
The sooner the better." "Wished I was dead," said she. "I say, Sambo, you go to spilling the hands. I tell massa o' you," said Quimbo, who was busy at the mill, from which he had viciously driven two or three tired women who were waiting to grind their corn. "And I tell him you won't let the women come to the mill, yo nigger," said Sambo. "Yo just keep your own row."
Tom was hungry with his day's journey, and almost faint for want of food.
"There yo," said Quimbo, throwing down a coarse bag, which contained a peck of corn. "There, nigger, grab, take care on it. You won't get no more dish your week."
Tom waited till a late hour to get a place at the mills, and then moved by the utter weariness of two women, whom he saw trying to grind their corn there, he ground for them, put together the decaying brands of the fire, where many had baked cakes before them, and then went about getting his own supper. It was a new kind of work there, a deed of charity, small as it was, but it woke an answering touch in their hearts. An expression of womanly kindness came over their hard faces. They mixed his cake for him, and tended its baking, and Tom sat down by the light of the fire, and drew out his Bible, for he had need for comfort.
"What's that?" said one of the women.
"A Bible," said Tom.
"Good Lord! I ain't seen none since I was in Kentuck."
"Was you raised in Kentuck?" said Tom, with interest.
"Yes, and well raised, too. Never expected to come to dis year," said the woman, sighing.
"Was that our book, anyway?" said the other woman.
"Why, the Bible."
"Laws o' me, what's that?" said the woman.
"Do tell, you never heard on it," said the other woman. "I used to hear missus a-readin' on it sometimes in Kentuck. Laws o' me, we don't hear nothing here but crackin' and swearin'."
"Read a piece anyway," said the first woman, curiously, seeing Tom attentively poring over it. Tom read, "Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest."
"Them's good words enough," said the woman. "Who says 'em?"
"The Lord," said Tom.
"I just wish I'd know where to find him," said the woman. "I would go pairs like I never should get rested again. My flesh is fairly sore, and I tremble all over every day. Sambo's always a-jawin' at me, 'cause I doesn't pick faster, and nights it's most midnight before I can get my supper, and then pairs like I don't turn over and shut my eyes before I hear the horn blow to get up, and at it again the morning. If I knew where the Lord was, I'd tell him."
"He's here.
He's everywhere," said Tom. "Lord, you ain't going to make me believe that are. I know the Lord ain't here," said the woman. "'Tain't no use talking, though. I just going to camp down and sleep what I can."
The women went off to their cabins, and Tom sat alone by the smoldering fire that flickered up redly in his face. The silver, fair-browned moon rose in the purple sky, and looked down calm and silent as God looks on the scene of misery and oppression, looked calmly on the lone black man as he sat, with his arms folded and his Bible on his knee.
"Is God here?"
Ah, how is it possible for the untaught heart to keep its faith unswerving in the face of dire misrule and palpable, unrebuked injustice? In that simple heart waged a fierce conflict, the crushing sense of wrong, the foreshadowing of a whole life of future misery, the wreck of all past hopes mournfully tossing in the soul's sight like dead corpses of wife and child and friend, rising from the dark wave and surging in the face of the half-drowned mariner. Was it easy here to believe and hold fast the great password of Christian faith, that God is and is the rewarder of them that diligently seek him? Tom rose, disconsolate, and stumbled into the cabin that had been allotted to him. The floor was already strewn with weary sleepers, and the foul air of the place almost repelled him. But the heavy night dews were chill, and his limbs weary, and wrapping around him a tattered blanket, which formed his only bed clothing, he stretched himself in the straw and fell asleep. In dreams a gentle voice came over his ear. He was sitting on the mossy seat in the garden by Lake Pontchartrain, and Eva, with her serious eyes bent downward, was reading to him from the Bible, and he heard her read, "When thou passest through the waters, I will be with thee, and the rivers, they shall not overflow thee. When thou walkest through the fire, thou shalt not be burnt, neither shall the flame kindle upon thee, for I am the Lord thy God, the Holy One of Israel, thy Saviour. Gradually the words seemed to melt and fade, as in a divine music. The child raised her deep eyes and fixed them lovingly on him, and rays of warmth and comfort seemed to go from them to his heart, and as if wafted on the music, she seemed to rise on shining wings, from which flakes and spangles of gold fell off like stars. And she was gone. Tom woke. Was it a dream? Let it pass for one. But who shall say that that sweet young spirit, which in life so yearned to comfort and console the distressed, was forbidden of God to assume this ministry after death? It is a beautiful belief that ever round our head are hovering on angel wings the spirits of the dead.
Chapter 33. Cassie. And behold the tears of such as were oppressed, and they had no comforter. And on the side of their oppressors there was power, but they had no comforter. Ecclesiastes 4:1. It took but a short time to familiarize Tom with all that was to be hoped or feared in his new way of life. He was an expert and efficient workman in whatever he undertook, and was both from habit and principle prompt and faithful. Quiet and peaceable in his disposition, he hoped by unremitting diligence to avert from himself at least a portion of the evils of his condition. He saw enough of abuse and misery to make him sick and weary, but he determined to toil on with religious patience, committing himself to him that judgeth righteously, not without hope that some way of escape might yet be open to him. Legree took a silent note of Tom's availability. He rated him as a first-class hand, and yet he felt a secret dislike to him. The native antipathy of bad to good. He saw plainly that when, as was often the case, his violence and brutality fell on the helpless, Tom took notice of it. For so subtle is the atmosphere of opinion that it will make itself felt without words, and the opinion even of a slave may annoy a master. Tom in various ways manifested a tenderness of feeling, a commiseration for his fellow sufferers, strange and new to them, which was watched with a jealous eye by Legree. He had purchased Tom with the view of eventually making him a sort of overseer, with whom he might at times entrust his affairs in short absences. And in his view the first, second, and third requisite for that place was hardness. Legree made up his mind that as Tom was not hard to his hand, he would harden him forthwith. In some few weeks after Tom had been on the place, he determined to commence the process. One morning, when the hands were mustered for the field, Tom noticed with surprise a newcomer among them, whose appearance excited his attention. It was a woman, tall and slenderly formed, with remarkably delicate hands and feet, and dressed in neat and respectable garments. By the appearance of her face, she might have been between 35 and 40, and it was a face that once seen could never be forgotten, one of those that at a glance seemed to convey to us an idea of a wild, painful, and romantic history. Her forehead was high, and her eyebrows marked with beautiful clearness. Her straight, well-formed nose, her finely cut mouth, and the graceful contour of her head and neck showed that she must once have been beautiful. But her face was deeply wrinkled with lines of pain, and of proud and bitter endurance. Her complexion was sallow and unhealthy, her cheeks thin, her features sharp, and her whole form emaciated. But her eye was the most remarkable feature, so large, so heavily black, overshadowed by long lashes of equal darkness, and so wildly, mournfully despairing. There was a fierce pride and defiance in every line of her face, in every curve of the flexible lip, in every motion of her body, but in her eye was a deep, settled night of anguish, an expression so hopeless and unchanging as to contrast fearfully with the scorn and pride expressed by her whole demeanor. Where she came from or who she was, Tom did not know. The first he did know, she was walking by his side, erect and proud, in the dim gray of the dawn. To the gang, however, she was known, for there was much looking and turning of heads, and a smothered yet apparent exultation among the miserable, ragged, half-starved creatures by whom she was surrounded. "Got to come to it at last, glad of it," said one. "Hee-hee-hee," said another. "You'll know how good it is, missy. We'll see her work. Wonder if she'll get it cutting up at night like the rest of us. I'd be glad to see her down for a flogging outbound."
said another. The woman took no notice of these taunts, but walked on with the same expression of angry